John.
Hello, Scott.
Do you like movies?
I love movies.
Do you like looking at the juxtaposition of lives that exist in cities where there are incredible disparities and confusing subcultures all existing in once?
Sounds fascinating.
I would agree. This is Popcorn Eschaton, a show that exists on the channel of Zebras in America, hosted by me, Scott Thurow, and John Arminio, where we discuss movies, usually with a leftist lens and a religious lens, and sometimes we get to discuss movies where both of the intersections hit. Sometimes it's just leftism, sometimes it's just religion, but obviously both of those things are very much intermixed. I am essentially a non-Marxist socialist because in the fact that I really mess with Marx. I think people should read Capital, though I do think someone who's smarter than me should make a more readable version of it. And I know there are some Praxis people hearing that and getting very upset. But I mess with Marx, but I believe in God. And I feel like you mess with Marx, but you also believe in God. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. That's fair, yeah. Also, to be silly, when we say that we look at film through a leftist and or religious lens, can we start referring to that as our eschatogoggles?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
So we look at films through our eschatogoggles. And, you know, that's what we'd be doing.
Hell yeah.
So John, today I decided to present two films that are documentaries, controversial both in and out of the, not just the subject matter, not just the film, and not just the things surrounding the film or the characters in the film, but also films about New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And the juxtapositions. Because like most American cities, and I thoroughly suggest anybody read The Death and Life of American Cities. It's just beautiful, excellent book that talks about these sort of things. Cities fluctuate, but in all cities there are the rich and the poor and the in-between. And more so now, many cities, it's really just the rich and the poor. There's not as much in-between.
Mm-hmm.
But the films I chose to discuss today are films that are very dear to my heart. They're controversial films, but I think they're excellent. And they have to do with New York. And they are Paris is Burning and 80 Blocks from Tiffany's. John, tell me about Paris is Burning.
Yeah, so Paris is Burning is the 1990 documentary about the New York ball scene directed by Jenny Livingston. And so at the time, this was a relatively underground phenomenon in New York where members of the queer community would, you know, put on what we would now call drag shows. But at the time, they were referred to as, you know, a ball. And it really delves into the cultural phenomenon of balls, how important they are into the queer community in New York, how much it plays into the sense of self-worth of that community, and also how the fantasy of wealth and fame and success and acceptance is sort of channeled through these performances and this community, and how, especially after the 80s and during the 80s, how the unavoidable oppressiveness of like white capitalism has transformed the American dream to the point that where black queer people fantasize about like the white American dream that has presented them through mass media, and the confluence of that, and also the turning that sort of cultural oppression into self-actualization is sort of what the ball is all about. And and investigating that topic and those lives and those stories through 78 minutes is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. So I'm going to say something pretty out there. I think Paris is Burning is one of the greatest documentaries ever made.
It's pretty great.
And yep. It pains me to say it because there's so much about the making and aftermath of it that's incredibly problematic.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of the complications. And also, it's not lost on John and I at all that we are two cishet white dudes talking about this film about LGBTQ people of color in New York City in the late 80s, early 90s. And I will talk about the power of language shortly in relationship to this movie. And I would be super happy to revisit this movie with a critic of color, or, you know, I was unsuccessful in finding someone that I knew, and that's a blind side that I have, that was willing, not willing, but able to talk about this movie in the turnaround time that we had. But so this film introduces all of these cultural things that are popular now, the term shade, the term reed, voguing, chopping, all of that stuff is actually very popular in the zeitgeist again now because things cycle like a bike. But voguing is having a moment now. And, you know, the term shade is all through our vernacular. But this is 1990 talking about shade and talking about reed. And like many subcultures in American culture, whether it be dance music or disco, or a lot of it comes from black queer culture.
Yeah.
So this is before Madonna's song Vogue, which is it's very controversial because she basically whitewashed this very of color phenomenon. When you see this movie and you see the dances and the balls and these people, these are black spaces. There's very few white people in this movie, aside from the director. Again, this movie is not without its problems, but it presents a culture concisely, thoughtfully, brutally, and it's also beautiful. It's a beautiful looking film. The cinematography is incredible. And the characters are tragically magnetizing. Care to add a couple thoughts? I feel like I'm just babbling. Yeah.
You know, one of the most fascinating aspects of the movie is the intergenerational aspect of the film, where there's these seen mothers. The two most prominent ones are Pepper LaBeija and Dorian Corey, who take it upon themselves to be the mentors and the parents to not only the scene, like, in general, but to kids who ran away from home because of a bad situation with their parents and their family, and you know, to the point where they like literally change their name to Extravaganza or Labasia or Ninja, and are taken in by these communities. So it's not just about, you know, dancing and dressing up. Like, this is literally their family. And the contrast in the movie, but like the wisdom of like the mother figures to the younger kid, and the world weariness of some of the older interviewees with the like the bright eyed fantasy of the younger ones. It's really striking, and just to get this contrast of like wisdom with youth energy, I think is pretty incredible. And even with all of the spectacular dancing and voguing and costumes, like that's something that just really hit me hard, especially on these rewatches.
Right. And also the juxtaposition of this beauty, this elegance, this repurposing of white clothing to make their own statement, and how they're able to make these looks work, the high fashion and the beauty in 1990, in 1989. This is when there's, you know, again, things cycle like a bike, but the laws against gay people in that time frame were insane. This is, you're still dealing with the AIDS epidemic, rampant homophobia. This is a safe haven for, you know, youth and elders that is devastating. If you go to this movie's Wikipedia and look at the characters, pretty much they are all not with us anymore.
Yeah. You know, and yeah, it's not just complications from AIDS. It's things like a heart condition or diabetes, things that could have been prevented if, hey, we had a functional healthcare system in this country and not let poor people just like wither away and die by their late 50s because they can't afford healthcare. It's pretty depressing.
Yeah, I mean, almost all the main characters from this movie are no longer with us. And even by the end of the movie, one of the main characters has been murdered.
Yeah.
Because, and again, so it's really complex because the language used in the movie is language that we wouldn't use now. The language used to describe and empower LGBTQ populations has grown and changed throughout time and is constantly growing and changing throughout time. Like the term queer that we're using now, in 1990, that was just a straight up epithet or used loosely in very academic circles.
Whereas in this movie, they freely use the F word to refer to each other.
Right. And like the terms used for trans people and the difference between trans people, people that like to dress as other genders, drag queens and drag kings, was a lot more murky back then, and not in any way to be unkind. It's just, again, language is a living organism, and there just was different language back then. And, you know, like, you know, sometimes when people talk about Marsha P. Johnson, you know, who basically the hero of Stonewall, who died a very controversial death, in my mind. I mean, people have different opinions about it. Like, the way people describe her, right, is hard because the language is growing. The language is different.
Yeah. I mean, even Pepper LaBeija, this might be generational too, because you know she was a lot older than the other subjects, but she uses and preferred to use female pronouns, but she considered herself a man. And that's entirely her choice, obviously. But, you know, that it just like a linguistic path that we have to travel and engage with this movie and the different generations of LGBTQ people that are in this movie and that are, you know, watching this movie now.
And yeah, this movie occasionally gets like resurfaced every few years, and me and my partner were watching it again because they were thinking of showing it in a class that they teach, and I will never turn down watching this movie. It's on Criterion Channel, which I think slowly we're going to realize that, you know, we're going to have to divest from all these streaming services. I don't know how many streaming services you're subscribed to, John, but I'm starting to slow down. I'm starting to like unsubscribe because it's so much. I already unsubscribed to Disney because I don't really fuck with the way they do things.
Yeah.
And I think Criterion is one of the best bang for your bucks if you're mm-hmm. trying to explore cinema, whatever you want, whatever you think cinema is. But I think it's one of the better curated channels. Max was doing so well back when I forget if they've lost Turner Classic Movies yet, but they got rid of a considerable amount of their oeuvre, and it's just not as good.
Yeah. I mean, and even also, if I had infinite money, which I don't, but the maddening way the major streaming services acquire and abandon content, you know, what's even the point of subscribing to these things if the things that you want them for are going to disappear, you know? Even if you purchase them digitally.
And that's also why Criterion is nice, is because they make tangible media, and they've been making tangible media since the Laserdisc. Mm-hmm. You know, they started as a Laserdisc company. What's really awesome sometimes on the Criterion Channel is that they have the stuff that would be on the DVD, which a lot of streaming services don't have. So... Yeah. When you watch Paris is Burning, there's featurettes and different things and interviews. And we recently watched Harlan County, which it's only a matter of time before we discuss that movie on this channel. But the featurettes, it's just night and day. Do you have a big DVD collection?
By modern standards, I would say yes, I do. By cinephile standards, I would say it feels like it's kind of meager. But in this age where not many people collect physical media, I would say it's substantial.
I mean, I have like 10 DVDs.
I have more than that, yeah.
But I also live near a incredible DVD VHS Laserdisc Museum called Beyond Video in Baltimore, where they have like 32,000 titles, and for a very affordable cost, you can just rent movies whenever. So mm-hmm. I'm very spoiled. I'm starting to consider to start collecting again the movies that I love, just because of streaming taking down movies, and because who knows, you know, maybe one day people will decide that all the stuff surrounding Paris is Burning is enough to be like, oh, we're not going to watch this movie anymore, right? And that's something that's going to happen when we discuss film and we discuss problematic film and we discuss complicated film. Are you familiar? Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the actual movie, but were you compelled by how many incredible characters there were and how brave it was for these people to live such authentic lives 30 something years ago?
Yeah. Where, I mean, there's
one more sentence. My sure. biggest apologies. While right now we're going through a new phase of particularly transphobia that's going on right now, but there was just this amazing growth in the past years. And don't get me wrong, there's still so many places to go, and it's very upsetting what's happening now. But it's still a difference night and day 30 years ago and now.
Yeah, I found, like, all these characters kind of extraordinary. Like, you know, where do you start? And, like, the way it ends, there's, like, this 7-minute credit sequence where we get a little bit of interviews and dance sequences. But these two teenage boys who are just hanging out, and we get a little bit of, like, fun bits of them throughout the movie, but some of the last words that we hear in the film are from these two kids, you know, getting to the spiritual aspect of this podcast. Just like people in a religious community want to pray together, gay people just want to be together. And so, you know, these two teenagers are like equating the ball community and just the queer community in New York in general as a spiritual community, that this is where they commune with each other. And like, it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, also coming from a military family, seeing Sol Pendavis just willing to be interviewed in his military uniform. Mm-hmm. And he's still alive. Wait,
30 years before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed.
Yeah. So this is before Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Exactly.
So you could,
yeah.
So he could be dishonorably discharged. Now he officially retired in the early 2010s. So I'm assuming he would have been in the National Guard. And he retired as an officer, so he might have been an officer at this point, so it would have been very difficult to dishonorably discharge him. But regardless, he was putting a lot at risk appearing in his uniform in this film. And, you know, my dad served with people who were basically out, but because they knew they could trust their CO, they could live in the military relatively safely, but still, like, I found just so much of these characters and these people like extraordinary and inspiring.
Yeah, and yeah, it's just like incredibly brave. The characters, I mean, there's this scene where they're basically stealing from Roy Rogers.
Yeah,
and like explaining how like the way that they're able to wear all this name brand stuff is that they essentially rack, which is, you know, it's something that we'll probably discuss in the next film, and something that we'll discuss stuff as well. And, you know, I don't feel too badly about, shoplifting luxury goods from luxury stores. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just like, all of these characters, even the ones that are, you know, not your favorite, you're just like, I fucking love these people.
Yeah.
And I just want to know more. And I'm just like enthralled every time that it happens. But, you know, obviously the film was very controversial upon its release, right?
Mm.
while it was critically lauded by many, and it won a lot of independent awards and was very much loved by many. One of my spiritual mentors, someone whose work truly changed the way I viewed masculinity, especially in context to capitalism and intersectionality, Bell Hooks, who, as we remember, if you remember one of our episodes talking about Daughters of the Dust, was involved in the making of that film, heavily criticized the film, saying that a lot of it was a spectacle for white viewers and white spectators, and that questioned some of the political efficacy of the drag balls themselves. And I wonder if Bell Hooks changed her mind over time, because maybe in 1990, these very capitalistic seeming, very beautiful and aesthetic parties maybe didn't feel subversive, but watching 30 years from now, feel incredibly subversive and incredibly political, whether they want to or not, because I think in a world of subjugation, in a world of, you know, oppression, just to exist and to exist loudly is its own form of subversion. But I do understand that this film made by a white person is going to have that lens, is going to have somewhat of a voyeuristic lens, and it does have problems.
And there's an inherent problem with, I think, the cinephile community, or the art film community in general, that it's overwhelmingly white. If you're going to submit to a film festival, especially 1990, the jury is most likely going to be a bunch of cis white men. And the people who are writing about this movie, with a notable exception of Bell Hooks, obviously, are going to be white men. And so I think the cultural prism that this film was viewed in was through white men. And so I think, yeah, like you said, hopefully in the years since, other voices have been able to give opinions and maybe even be inspired by this movie.
And even when the film came out, there's a lot of issues with it. And I would be interested in hearing any of our listeners. You can use the zebraspod@gmail.com email address to ask any questions, and we'll try to answer them on air as best as we can. How you feel about the movie 30 years from now, and how it feels as a cultural artifact, and how it feels as a piece of art, especially considering all the laws and all the moral panic that exists around the LGBTQ community, and especially drag performances, which is very confusing because RuPaul's Drag Race and that whole genre and the podcasts by people who are on that show is one of the most popular pieces of entertainment in America.
Yeah.
And then you have all this moral panic over drag shows and drag queen story hour and all this stuff. And what I'm going to say, my very praxical thought to people that are losing their minds over drag story hour: get the fuck on, man. Like, I know that I've said this before on the show, but, you know, the governor of West Virginia was so proud of himself last year for passing so many bills against drag queens and trans people in sports, even though there were no reported trans people in sports in West Virginia, when they were lowest in literacy, lowest in poverty. You know, this is not real.
Yeah.
And it's just let people live their lives. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, being a Catholic person, I'm very aware of the litany of abuse committed by various members of the church, not just in America, but all over the world. And nobody's making laws banning priests from being in the same room as children. And, you know, the amount of prosecutions of trans people molesting children, you could probably count on one hand. So it's incredibly hypocritical and disgusting, and you're ruining people's lives for your own political gain, for political grandstanding, and it's reprehensible.
Are you familiar with some of the controversy about the film when it came out?
I'm familiar with some of it. I know that if my memory serves, like, none of the interview subjects were invited to the premiere, and nope. It seems like the director was distancing herself from her subjects, but they some of the subjects sort of stormed the premiere. After the film was completed, I think some of them felt specifically exploited for that reason.
Yes, and there was sort of verbal, gentle person's agreements that the participants were going to receive some compensation, and that was not the case. And many tried to sue, but unfortunately they had all signed standard releases. So, you know, none of that really happened. And the director Livingston has sort of downplayed this stuff and just has sort of just been like, look, this is nonfiction. This is journalism for the most part. When making journalism, people who are subjects are not paid. But I do think there might have been some dishonesty in the making the movie.
Yeah, it seems like it was a very labored production process. Like, I think she jumped through a lot of hoops and begged and borrowed to get the funding. And so I think when you're in that environment and under that pressure, maybe you do lie to your subjects to get the interviews on camera. That's not, you know, best practices, obviously, for a documentarian. I wish maybe she could have performed her job more ethically, but it's also, you know, sometimes desperate people commit desperate acts. And I also know her father died in 1990, so maybe she wasn't in the best headspace to send out premiere invites. But still, you wish people who make art like this could be more ethical in their behavior outside of the art, for sure.
Especially when, like, much of the film's crux is that a lot of these people feel not part of the cultures that often take from the culture. Absolutely. So it's a little bit, you know, contradictory that this film about people not feeling comfortable in spaces would somehow not have those people in the spaces. You know, there's a scene where one of the characters is showing their model looks at, like, this open model casting, and I feel like there were possibly some missed opportunities for these people to get jobs by not including them in there. And I just think that, unfortunately, it is a blemish on this film.
And even if it's for your own, like, economic prosperity, like, these are some of the most charismatic people that I've ever seen, like, on camera, period. And so wouldn't you want to have them do interviews to support this film, to have them at premieres to promote this film? Like, it seems like you would want to have them traveling the world promoting this movie with you and for you. So to distance yourself from them just seems, like, bizarre and inexplicable.
Yeah, it really bothers me. And if I ever were to, you know, talk to this person, I would ask some questions. I still stand by that. It's a remarkable piece of art. Yeah. And one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. And a movie that does what a good documentary should do.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't just have good subject matter. It also presents the subject matter well, which is my big issue with documentaries. I used to really not like documentaries at all. That was a big thing that when Zebras in America came out, I was like, I don't like documentaries. And now it still takes me a little bit, you know, narrative films are still my favorite, but you know, I take art as it comes.
And a big shout out to editor Jonathan Oppenheim, who I think crafted hours and hours of interview and ball footage into this 78-minute, like, lightning bolt of a documentary. So I think oftentimes documentary, like, the editor is like the co-director, because most of the time there's no script, so you have to create the script in the editing room. So an extraordinary piece of editing by him.
And then we have to really talk about the fact, one, you know, none of Livingston's movies even have Wikipedia pages besides Paris is Burning.
Yeah.
You know, she really came through with this one. But what's also really wild is, you know, the characters in this movie. I mean, if you just go through the list and just like see where people are, they're again, pretty much almost all of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But are you familiar with the situation of Dorian Corey?
The fact that there was a mummified body found in her apartment after she died?
Yes.
Wow. Wild.
Right.
I did hear a couple theories that maybe that she knew embalming and that she killed someone in self-defense, or that after she died, because there were so many people in and out of her apartment moving stuff around, like, for her, that someone who had committed murder sort of snuck in a body in all that hubbub. But I think it's still unexplained.
Right. I don't know if Corey did it. It's just really insane, really wild that when she passed away, they found what was probably a 25-year mummified corpse.
Yeah.
it's really wild. And again, like, you just click on every character, you know, and person. Dorian Corey passed away in 1993. Pepper, 2003. Venus, she died before the movie came out. Octavia Saint Laurent, 2009. Carmen Extravaganza passed away just last year. Ninja, 2006. Mm-hmm. Angie Extravaganza, 93. I'm just saying, like, that's crazy. And so when people try to discount, again, because as you were saying, some of these things were not just like violence, right? They're yeah. diabetes and other things. But is it any coincidence how diabetes affects certain populations that are highly stressed out? That high blood pressure affects populations that are oppressed? Like, come on. And the fact that healthcare for LGBTQ population is often terrible. In fact, there's so many states that are trying to just make it impossible. And at the recording of this podcast recently, there's the death of Nex Benedict, a non-binary teenager in Oklahoma who, you know, we're still waiting to hear more about the cause of their death, but they were forced into certain bathrooms based on laws by religious zealots who clearly don't read the books for which their faith is based, and was bullied and beaten and then died the next day.
Yeah.
And again, I want to be very careful about ongoing legal things, so I don't know. But I'm just saying, hate is learned. And the fact that we're dealing with this stuff over and over again, and it's becoming a new moral panic, is just very depressing.
Yeah. On the bright side of that, if anyone listening lives in Pennsylvania, the Eastern PA Trans Equity Project expanded into Central Pennsylvania and added eight counties to its territory. So that expands trans healthcare from what was a mostly Philadelphia area reach to a much more rural area here in Central Pennsylvania. So that's you know, like one positive thing that is going on now. Like, there are extraordinary good people who are, you know, trying to serve this community. I wish it wasn't up to equity projects, and that, you know, maybe the government could provide healthcare for these communities. But right now it's up to community organizations, I guess.
Yeah, I wish GoFundMe wasn't the number one insurance provider in the country.
Jesus Christ, yeah. Just because we were talking about Doreen Corey, one bit towards the end of the film that I found extraordinary was just her philosophy. I think that's become one of the most famous moments in the movie. You've left your mark on the world if you just get through it and a few people remember your name. I think it's better if you just enjoy it. Pay your dues and just enjoy it. If you shoot an arrow and it goes real high, hooray for you. And obviously she delivers it with much more sort of attitude and sass than I could imitate. But I just found her to be like a really remarkable person. And even with all the controversy around this movie, I'm thankful it exists just so these people can make themselves known to the world at large. Like, I think their stories deserve to be told, and it's great that they got to look into a camera and tell it.
Absolutely. So I think that is about as good a segue as any to talk about the second film that we will be discussing today. I guess this is my fault, really. Got to figure out a way how to do a better job of dividing the movies we sometimes talk about, because it certainly feels like the first movie we talk about, we tend to talk about longer than the second movie. In this one, it's kind of by design because this is sort of like the amuse-bouche, where what I really wanted to talk about was Paris is Burning. And I really want people to see Paris is Burning because I just think, again, warts and all, there it's one of the great films about subcultures, countercultures, and celebrating LGBTQ spaces of color.
Absolutely.
So tell me about 80 Blocks from Tiffany's.
So 80 Blocks from Tiffany's is a 1979 or 1980, depending on your source, documentary directed by Gary Weiss, who made his name doing shorts for Saturday Night Live. And this, he sort of did this as a summer project for NBC. But it's about gang life in South Bronx. And he profiles the Savage Nomads and the Savage Skulls, two rival gangs, as well as the community surrounding them and some of the cops who police the area. And you get some pretty frank discussion from the gang members over their lives, their living situations, why they're there, the crimes they commit, and the community's opinion of them. And you also get a pretty stark view of the living conditions in the South Bronx during the late 70s and early 80s. And it's up on YouTube, so, and it's only 67 minutes, so I highly recommend everybody take a look at it.
And it's 67 minutes of just nonstop, because one, the title is basically the idea that in the same vicinity as the film Breakfast at Tiffany's is this other world. Mm-hmm. And again, the disparity of the haves and the have-nots in New York City in 1979, 1980 is so different than it might be as well. It's starting to change again. The pandemic really affected New York City, and there's definitely a bigger gap between the haves and the have-nots, and crime is on the rise, and there's sort of a nihilism to New York City that exists now that I haven't seen since the 90s, growing up in New York City during David Dinkins and Rudy Giuliani era New York City. There's this nihilism. I've seen people just smoking crack on the train or just committing crime. The last time I was in New York City, I saw 7 people hopping the turnstile. And a lot of people think I look like a cop. So they're just like, essentially thinking, just like, ah, fuck it, you know? And
yeah.
So what you're seeing in 80 Blocks from Tiffany's is like rap is starting. We're in the middle of the crack epidemic, and we're just seeing this other world. And the first time I saw this movie, it threw my head through. It was so confusing to me and frustrating, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just, even if you grow up in New York City, you don't go to the Bronx that much if you're not from the Bronx, right? And the South Bronx is such an important character to my life because of rap music and also, you know, there's a lot of movies I love that come from the South Bronx. And then if you fetishize gang culture, like maybe the movie The Warriors. Have you ever heard of the film The Warriors?
I love The Warriors.
And I love that movie too, but it's, this movie is the real Warriors, right?
Yeah.
Where The Warriors is sort of just an Odysseus story by Walter Hill, where my favorite movie of his is Streets of Rage. Is that what it's called? The musical?
Streets of Fire.
Streets of Fire, excuse me. Streets of Rage is the 1990s
video game.
Video game where part three has a fighting kangaroo. I don't know.
Yeah. But we should do an episode on Streets of Rage.
I would love to. I would love to do an episode about the game Streets of Rage and the movie Streets of Fire because I love musicals. We talked about Les Miserables. We've talked about musicals on this show before. So, but The Warriors is a sort of cartoonish story of gang life in this time in New York City, which is not the case from 80 Blocks from Tiffany's. Again, this is raw.
Yeah, it's there's so many things I was fascinated about this movie. Like the, you know, there's this perception that gang life is so strictly like racially segregated, and the savage nomads seem to be pretty integrated, like just as integrated as the South Bronx is or was as a community. And it was also fascinating, just like their costumes were just as sort of like out there as Warriors costumes, but they're just a lot of Nazi imagery. You know, they're just trying to be so as confrontational and as shocking as possible. And certainly, like, if they're an SS helmet, that's pretty confrontational. And I know this was performative for the cameras.
Sure.
But there's also, like, a very casual relationship that they have with the cops, which I found fascinating. And, like, they certainly discuss being hassled and being unjustly arrested by the police, but we see them, like, joking around with cops and cops saying, like, you know, whatever. They know not to open carry or carry drugs around when we're around because they know we'll search them, and so they don't. So we don't really bother each other. And like, that kind of attitude, like, just so fascinated me because, you know, I'm not naive as to how, like, cops treat poor black people, but it seems like there's, with the militarization of the police in the decades since, it seems like they're, like, there's battle lines between these communities. Whereas even in this crime-ridden, poverty-stricken community, at least they could, like, have a conversation with each other and, like, know the names of the cops that are in the neighborhood. And so I found that just very, like, and there's clearly tension between the cops and the gang members, but it, you know, at least they could, like, walk by each other without, like, cops arresting somebody for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, like, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and Melly Mel, who is, like, the first really good rapper, talking about these worlds, you're like, there's no way that this is real. And then you see these movies and you're like, oh my God, this is real. Even if the film is, again, hammed up.
Yeah.
Why do you think I paired this movie?
I think there are two incredible time capsules of New York. I think they both highlight poor non-white communities, and I think they both challenge us as white men, especially me as a non-New Yorker, to look at these communities that aren't ours and try and negotiate what these pieces of art are telling us. And, you know, I think it is up to us, especially, like, if we're going to be doing a podcast about these topics, like, we have to confront these issues and not be afraid of them. And it'd be, you know, wonderful if we did have somebody on the podcast with us, but I don't think we can't wait for someone to, like, hold our hand along to guide us through. And I think we have to be ready to make a mistake in how we talk about these movies and these subjects if we're gonna, you know, accomplish anything.
Right. And I plan to, I know that I will make mistakes and and not be perfect in mm-hmm. this in the work that we do, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm willing to be called in and to navigate and understand and learn.
Yeah.
And I don't think 80 Blocks from Tiffany's is a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's worth watching, especially since you can see it on YouTube. And I think it's an interesting time capsule to understanding New York City and the class war that happened in the late 80s.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like, so much of this descends from, like, quote-unquote urban renewal and, you know, redlining that happened decades earlier and the urban deterioration that happened because of the disinterest of the powers that be on these spaces where so many communities were living that led to the degradation of these buildings that made them like not profitable for landlords and, you know, led to there were some of the systemic causes of the Bronx fires of this era. And so this film really just like scrapes the surface of all that and really focuses on the gang culture. But I think the gang culture is connected to those enormous systemic problems. So I think this film is a really good entry point into that very broad and very difficult subject.
I couldn't say it better myself. As we wrap off, do you have any thoughts?
Just that I had a really great time talking about these movies with you, Scott, and I really appreciate this conversation.
Yeah, and so, yeah, for all the listeners who may not have seen these movies, I challenge you to watch them and let us know what you think. Because, you know, interaction, especially when, you know, we're guests in these films,
mm-hmm.
wheelhouse, you know, when... Yeah. Let us know, please.
Please.